lose my faith, that I'd had this wonderful experience in college and law school and had terrific training, been part of a great church, and then that somehow I would get out into the world and I would sort of lose that enthusiasm for Christ.
Rich Dean has been practicing law for over 30 years in Russia, Australia, and now Washington, D.C.
When I was in law school, there was a segment of my peer group that viewed going to work for major corporations, or frankly, going to work for major law firms like I was doing, as sort of selling your soul. Kind of made you think, am I really doing the right thing with my life? Is this a good thing or not? There would be then examples that would be highlighted in the corporate world that, would be held up as, reasons why all these people were without any moral fiber and would do anything for a profit. My particular era, it was the Ford Pinto cases, which are now a, bygone part of history. But Ford had this Pinto. It's been long discontinued, but it was a very successful car. The only problem was it had a fundamental design flaw where they put the gas tank too near the rear bumper. So in rear-end collisions, there were frequent explosions and fires. And, faced with this, at Ford, they made a judgment, at least initially, not to redesign the Pinto. And, obviously, this would bother anybody, right? I mean, I wasn't unique in feeling like this is outrageous.
Rich was meeting regularly with Tom Skinner, a well-known pastor in New York City.
The problem is we take our hang-ups and we deliver them to other people. We can't do that. If God puts people in particular thing, pray for those people and let them be salt there. Let people be in the world.
And so I remember one night at one of these dinners with Skinner, we were sitting around and somehow this case came up. And I said, I would never go to work for Ford Motor Company. I would not want to represent Ford Motor Company. And Skinner just, he was a big man. And I remember him just leaning back in his chair. And he said, well, tell me this. Would it be any different if you were in the boardroom? I thought, well, what are you talking about? He said, well, I want to know. I mean, what if you were in the boardroom? Would the decision be any different? And I thought, well, why are you asking me this question? I don't want to be in their boardroom. But it was so provocative, and it caused me to, I think, sort of fundamentally adjust my thinking about this and begin what for me was kind of a long path of what does it mean to be in the workplace trying to do the right thing? Was there a way to bring my faith into that could it make a difference?
Many of us.
We'll return to that lawyer's story later on, but I wanted to bring it up because I think it raises the issue that we all face every day in our lives that. And we have to make ethical decisions, and some of them, like the Ford Motor Company, are big ones, but then we also face smaller ones every day, and I think that's something that the passages we're looking at today, that they address. So that's a big ethical decision, how do we engage with Ford Motor Company as lawyers? But on a smaller scale, I think we have to make ethical decisions as well. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced it, but when you go to McDonald's with little kids, so I remember growing up, and, I always had the McChicken burger combo with Coke. I knew what I wanted. And our family all would sort of order their things. But every time, without fail, my sister Emily would be there at the end. Cheeseburger or chicken burger. Oh! And she would take about 10 minutes. And then she would get stuck on Fanta or Coke. And these were huge ethical decisions for my sister. Of course, there are slightly bigger ones than that. I don't know if anyone's ever dinged a car or scratched a car, and there's that immediate thing of, what do I do? They're not there. The car's left alone, and you've just touched it. What do you do? Sarah told me a story of when she was driving with a mate, and her mate backed into a car, and her mate was like, "Let's go," and she drove off, and Sarah had to say, "Whoa, whoa! We have to do something about that." It's easy to react in these moments and make a snap ethical decision. A few years ago, Sarah and I were driving and we pulled up at a pedestrian crossing and a car smashed into the back of us, rode off our car. That person had had faulty brakes that they hadn't dealt with. These are ethical decisions that we need to respond to, react to. The failure to deal with these sometimes murky decisions can be like leaving an ember smouldering, and you know how dangerous that can be. They can often lead to greater problems. Today, David's family issues, which we've been looking at over the last few weeks, they fan into flame, and they become a national crisis. David, who back in 1 Samuel had the Spirit-given imagination to respond to complex situations, we see him in these chapters as paralyzed by double-mindedness. We see David now torn between his role as king to bring justice against murderous Absalom and his role as father to reconcile with his son. So we're looking at chapters 14 to 19 today of 2 Samuel, and we won't read them all. What I've got instead is this booklet from the Stations of Samuel Day. Do you remember that? Where we walked through the whole church and had all these great things. And Bryn wrote some fantastic notes for this. So I want to read out Bryn's notes. Thank you, Bryn. So if you have your Bibles, maybe try and follow along just loosely, skim reading. But let's hear some headlines from chapters 14 to 19 of 2 Samuel. So, chapter 13, revenge with a side of lamb kofta. Absalom, Tamar's brother, manipulates Amnon to a sheep shearer's feast and kills Amnon. Again in chapter 13, just a renegade who had it made. Great titles, Bryn. David weeps over Amnon. Absalom runs away. Yet David wants Absalom back. Moving on to chapter 14, wisdom, Tekoa style. Wise woman Tekoa, who is guided by Joab, goes to David and turns his mind. She changes him on his view about Absalom and gets him to bring him back. Easy on the outcasts. David, you let outcasts re-enter your presence. Why won't you let Absalom come back? Long locks. Absalom, whose hair was cut once a year, set Joab's field on fire to entice Joab for a meeting with David, after which David forgives. So there's this long process of David and Absalom being reconciled. It takes 4 to 5 years. Following that, People's Choice Award, chapter 15. Absalom steals the heart of people of Israel, and his rebellious conspiracy against David grows in power. Later in chapter 15, got a plan? Run away as fast as you can. David orders his people to flee Jerusalem away from Absalom. His reaction is very quick. Let's go. Again in chapter 15, undercover. David sends Hushai to spy on Absalom. Moving on to chapter 17, y'all got counseled. Hushai the spy gives advice to Absalom and also gives the plan to David, so he's playing his spy role well. The war strategies are actioned. Chapter 18, forests that kill. In the fight, David's troops fight Absalom's troops. Absalom's troops die, more of them by the forest trees than by the war. Chapter 18, bad hair day. Absalom's hair gets caught in a tree. He's left hanging between heaven and earth. He can't move, and Joab kills him. Dear Abby, a messenger, a Cushite, gives David the real scoop on what's happened. Absalom, your son, is dead. Chapter 19, get over it, dude. David, lamenting Absalom's death, is told by Joab to man up and encourage his demoralized troops. David sits before his soldiers at the city gates. So those are our chapters for today. And I would encourage you, when you have time, to go home and read them. But we'll let that suffice for now. So I think we've got a slide. So when the wise woman appeals to David to bring Absalom home, this is way back in chapter 14, I think, She says to him, "My lord the king is like the angel of God, discerning good and evil." That was the king's role, was to discern and to make just decisions. But the picture through these chapters of David isn't of a wise decision maker. Rather, it's of a man who's divided and double-minded. The woman asks David that Absalom be brought home, and David agrees to make it happen. But he does it in like a really strange, sort of messy, confusing way. With Absalom's homecoming, we expect something like the prodigal son. We expect this returning son to be greeted by a running father. But what we get is David going, "Oh, don't bring him right home. Send him to his room for 2 years. Can you imagine punishing your child like that? Go to your room. I'll come in 2 years. It's hard to know. Some kids probably need that, eh? It's hard to know what David really wants here, to embrace his wayward son or to have this rebel punished for murder. I think he's indecisive. And so instead of doing either, he just sits on his hands. You know, we've been talking about postures all the way through this. This one, David's sitting on his hands. And everyone else is kind of left scratching their heads. You know, what's your decision? Have you made a decision? Perhaps you can relate. Whenever I'm sitting on the couch watching TV or something, and Sarah asks, "Hey, Al, should we go to the beach or should we go to the hills? Or should we get fish and chips or pizza?" And I just reply, "Yes." I'm sort of absent-minded. Yeah, let's do that. And she goes, "Well, no, there were choices, you know. It was fish and chips or pizza, not just yes." And so I wonder if David's kind of doing that here. You know, there's, you know, bring Absalom home or have him killed. Yes. At the end of the story, later in chapter 18 and 19, David is still divided. After the battle, we get these two messengers who bring their reports to David, and he sits between the two gates at the town of Mahanaim, meaning twin camps. So there's this idea of two, of being stuck in the middle. And so just as Absalom was caught in the tree with his head here in the tree, and he was hanging between heaven and earth, so David was caught between his role as king and father. There's this stuckness. During the passage on his way to Mahanaim, on his way into exile, he comes across Ziba. Do you remember Ziba, the servant of Saul, and Mephibosheth? You remember these two characters? So on his way to exile, Ziba shows up. And so you remember how David had shown chesed kindness to Mephibosheth? He'd invited him to eat at his table, and it was this beautiful picture of justice. Well, Ziba protests just once. It's so quick. And David suddenly takes everything that he's given to Mephibosheth and gives it to Ziba. You know, it's kind of like he just shrugs and goes, "Oh yeah, let's do that." Then, on his way back to Jerusalem, after the war's been won, Mephibosheth comes to David and claims his innocence. You know, what was that about? And instead of dealing with this ethical dilemma, you know, who's wrong, who's right, again, David just says, "Yes." You know, he divides the land 50-50 between someone who's obviously in the wrong and someone who's obviously in the right. The woman's praise becomes sadly ironic. "My lord the king is like the angel of God, discerning good and evil." Well, I think that's hardly true. And the result of David's double-mindedness comes in this outcry in chapter 18. "Oh, Absalom, my son! My son, Absalom! If only I had died instead of you. Oh, my son, Absalom, oh, my son." David suddenly, finally sees what he wanted, but he sees it too late. I think the book of James sums up David's situation really well. "If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person, like David, is double-minded and unstable in all that they do. Double-mindedness gets us sitting on our hands when decisions need to be made. One of these issues that we need to be making decisions about at the moment is the environment. Who here gets the Papua Nui paper plane? The email? Yeah, a few of you? A few of you? Good. So recently in the Papua Nui paper plane, we've been doing a series called A Grain of Rice, and we've been looking at the environment. So we've done that for about 6 weeks now. And we've been exploring how being good stewards is our response to God's love for the whole creation, as attested in Scripture and personally in Jesus Christ. We care for God's handiwork, the creation, out of the conviction that Christ is Lord of that creation. Of course, this isn't just a Christian topic. Environmental care and global warming is a hot topic for all of us. See what I did there, the pun? Global warming is a hot topic for all of us. And so we hear talk about the environment everywhere. We hear it everywhere. Just the other day, I read that our atmospheric carbon levels have now passed 400 parts per million, which is a significant number, and that they won't return to environmentally friendly levels ever again for the indefinite future. The environment and our response to it has become a pressing issue. Like David, we've got big decisions to make. But despite all this talk that's going on, who's taking responsibility? In 2002, New Zealand ratified the Kyoto Protocol. But has that had the effect that it needed to have? In the past year, we've had the Paris Agreement, which we've heard lots about. And this commits us to reducing greenhouse gas emissions from 2020. And time will tell if that has any effect. This sort of stuff is really easy for us to say yes to, like I say yes on the couch, or like David said yes to these problems. But then we can easily sit on our hands and do nothing when action is required. The government, it sits on its hands. Corporations and businesses, they sit on their hands in general. And we can just as easily sit on our hands. So, the question is, how will we, as Papua Nui Baptist, as the people of God, take this seriously? How will we respond? Pauline White, who I think is here, yeah, she suggested that we have a non-waste month to help us become aware of how much waste we do produce. And we think this is great. So this is what we want to do, as we've got this initiative for church. In the month of November, we're going to be encouraging each other to do a non-waste month. Does that sound good? Yeah? That's quite a challenge, right? We produce a lot of waste. So that's the challenge for us, to have a non-waste month in November. So we need things like this to be actually responding, right? We need to actually have practical wisdom to respond to the big issues of our day. Because if we don't start to act, the effect, like for David, is that the next generation will be caught hanging between heaven and earth, and we'll be left weeping. In these stories, there's this other character that shows up in contrast to David. He's Joab. So Joab comes across as decisive, whereas David comes across as confusing and indecisive. Joab and his brother is a military man. These guys are hitmen. They're efficient. They're single-minded in their responses. These guys go by that old motto, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Their mode is vengeance. Because Abner had killed his brother, Joab went and murdered him. When David wanted Bathsheba's husband Uriah killed, Joab was his man. When Shimei pelts David and his men with stones and insults on their way to Mahanaim, they ask, can we kill him? When David wants the armies to deal gently with Absalom, Joab is the one who kills him. He repays him for burning his field. And when David makes Amasa head of his army in place of Joab, surprise, Joab kills him. Any of you Beatles fans here? I think of Bang Bang Maxwell's Silverhammer. Now, it's tempting to view Joab favorably in comparison to David, because at least he's still functioning At least he's doing something. When David is grieving and turning the army's victory to mourning and grief, it's Joab who comes up with the hard reminder. Hey, you're king. Start acting like one. The problem with Joab is that he responds to these complex issues with far too much simplicity. There's no sense of discernment here, no wise reflection on how we should respond. Instead of justice, there's just revenge. There's only reaction, animal instinct, violence. Jesus had to deal with similar men in his group of disciples. When they were traveling through Samaria on their way to Jerusalem, the Samaritans failed to host Jesus and his company. And so the brothers James and John, known as Sons of Thunder, asked, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them? Pretty impressive guys. James and John's response to the Samaritans is similar to Joab. It reveals this fervency, this anger. With David, we felt that temptation to sit on our hands when big decisions need to be made. I think we just as easily run into the problem of Joab being too quick, too passionate to respond and react with wisdom. Something Sarah and I talk about lots together, Sarah notices this especially on Facebook, is how quickly people can be to jump on the latest social justice issue. You know, we've got so much instant information at our fingertips. We've got the latest news about all the issues of the world. And it can be so tempting to form really quick opinions on all these things. You know, we've got a really intelligent younger generation that have all the answers. But not just the younger generation. I think many of us fall to this. And so without taking time to know the ins and outs of the big issues, we can too quickly become keyboard warriors. You know, sitting there going, yeah, that's the answer. We spout our passionate responses on Facebook to the problems of the world without wisdom and without discernment. Does anybody remember Kony 2012? Was that anything down here? So it was for you guys? Yeah. So Kony 2012 was this like massive Facebook thing. Back in 2012, there was a guy called Joseph Kony who was the commander of rebel armies, what they thought, in Uganda. And so Invisible Children's organization made this really sort of catchy video. And basically the idea was that everyone had to share this video to all their mates, and we had to make a really big fuss. And the goal of the video was that we would encourage the US to send their military to Uganda to get Joseph Kony. And so I saw this come up. It was a really powerful video. I shared it along with all my buddies. And we were all going, yeah, like, let's get him. Let's get Joseph. This was early in my time of knowing Sarah. And Sarah had just been in Uganda. And so she came back a couple of months later and was like, you realize that Joseph Kony isn't in Uganda? He's in Congo? Our response was just so simplistic to a complex issue. Like Joab's reactionary decision-making, the solution of Invisible Children and of us on our laptops was way too simplistic for something as complex and as murky as war in a land that we knew little about. Does anyone get the Papua Nui newsletter? So that's a local sort of newsletter that goes out to most of us here. And on the front page, there was a great article just this month from John O'Campbell, who works for Te Oroho. And he wrote a response. So has anyone heard of what's been happening at the library with the whiny noises? Yes. Yeah, so it's pretty average, eh? The library here has been playing these high-pitched whining noises to get kids to go away from their building because there's too much loitering. It's really shocking. But John O'Campbell's response was, I thought, really balanced, really thoughtful. Most of us, when we've heard this, have gone, oh, stupid library, those guys are dumb. But Jono, while recognising that that's an issue that does need to be changed, he was very fair in saying, well, hey, you know, that library is doing a lot of good things in this community. They've partnered with Te Oroho to put up an exhibition of art from the young people. They're not anti-young people. They just have made this one silly decision. So let's be fair in how we respond to them. Let's look at this in a bigger picture than just the one issue. And I think that's what I'm learning from David and from Joab, is that our responses need to be far more thoughtful than just get in there, stab, kill. But also they need to be more than just sitting on our hands, oh well, you know? Jesus comes as the great contrast to both David sitting on his hands and Joab with his simplistic reactions. Like Tamar, Jesus responds to these murky situations with single-minded wisdom and clarity. In Matthew 22, the Pharisees come to Jesus planning to trap him with their words. It's a familiar thing. "Teacher," they say, "we know that you're a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Tell us then, what's your opinion? Is it right to pay tax to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, says, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me a coin that you pay for tax." So they bring him a denarius, and he asks them, "Whose image is this? And whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they reply. Then he says to them, "So, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." When they hear this, they're amazed. So they leave him and go away. Or take John chapter 8. The Pharisees drag in an adulterous woman in order to stone her. Jesus doesn't sit on his hands in indecision, nor does he pick up his own stones to respond with violence to them. Instead, creatively, he bends down and starts scribbling on the dirt. And when they keep questioning him, he straightens up and says to them, "Let any of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stoops down and he scribbles on the floor. At this, those who hear begin to walk away, one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus is left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightens up again. "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," he declares. "Go now and leave your life of sin." In these situations, Jesus has a spirit-given imagination to respond creatively to the murky questions of his rivals. Unlike King David, Jesus is the king who responds, who discerns right and wrong, who discerns good and evil, and responds with single-minded wisdom. And instead of David's cry that if only it could have been him instead of his son, Jesus himself is the one who dies in our place, the lamb that takes away the sin of the world. As the church, as Papanui Baptist Church, participating in the mission of Jesus Christ, we too are called to respond to the murky ethical issues of our day with this spirit-given imagination, with this clear, single-minded wisdom from God. May we be a discerning and responsive people as we engage the world. Let's finish by watching part two of that lawyer's story.
Earlier, we saw that Rich Dean was afraid he'd lose his faith working for a secular law firm, but felt challenged to be God's representative in the midst of our messy world. It wasn't too long before he got his first chance to do this.
We were representing a company whose chief executive officer was going through a divorce.
This company asked Rich to exclude a future bonus that the CEO was going to receive.
I said, "Well, I mean, why would we do this? What's going on?" And the guy I work for said, "Well, our client told us that he's in the middle of a divorce and he does not want his wife to find out he's making an extra $3 million. I said, "Well, it doesn't seem to me that that's the right thing." I said, "Moreover, I think it makes the law firm look bad." And he said, "Look, we don't represent his wife, okay? We don't even represent him. We represent the company, our client, they're telling us what to do, go do it. I went back to my desk and I wrote up this list. I thought, this is just not right. So I went back to him. I said, look, I can't do this. And so he said, I'll tell you what, let's take it to the head of the department. I was a second or third year lawyer. I was like, what was I doing? I made my case. And he said, thought about it for a few minutes. He said, Rich, he said, Ed's right about this. We don't represent her. It's not our responsibility. But he said, we're not going to do it because it's just not right. And I just felt sort of vindicated that it was okay to talk about what was right and wrong in that context. But it was just kind of a confirmation that what Skinner had put me onto was just an important way of thinking about what I was doing. I think there are some kinds of opportunities for heroism where you do the right thing and it's great and you right the wrong. But the vast majority of situations, I mean, are just every day you're sort of struggling with something that's just far more gray. Studying the Old Testament has helped me appreciate that fallible people are still used by God in ways that we really can't figure out. Not in ways that I can necessarily see, or I may never see, but you trust are part of what God's doing.
We've learned that the story of Israel is the church's family history.
Cool. So, folks, would you stand with me? So, as we go into our weeks, we'll face ethical decisions. We'll face murky decisions that we can't just reply with a yes to. We have to actually think about how we're going to respond. And we can't just respond with the first impulse. We need to be thinking carefully about how we respond. So as we go into our weeks, may we go with a spirit-given imagination to speak with God's wisdom and clarity as we face the rights and wrongs of the world. Can you say with me the Lord's Prayer together? Our Father, who is in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our sins, as we forgive those who sin against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Amen.